War, and Lucia St. Clair Robeson's Ride the Wind, 1982. But the critical and commercial reaction to Lonesome Dove boggled the mind. Holding its own against Tom Clancy's The Hunt for Red October, John Irving's The Cider House Rules, and Louis L'Amour's Jubal Sackett, Lonesome Dove sold almost 300,000 copies in hardcover and more than a million when it was released in paperback. In 1986, the novel won the Pulitzer Prize. My newspaper colleagues told me not to give up on Lonesome Dove. It took some of them 40 pages, even 140 pages, before they really got into it. But McMurtry hooked me with the very first line. When Augustus came out on the porch, the blue pigs were eating a rattlesnake, not a very big one. After knocking off work on the sports desk around 1 a.m., I returned home and read the last 180-plus pages, finishing at sunrise in tears. What surprised McMurtry was how readers interpreted his novel. As he later wrote, "I thought I had written about a harsh time and some pretty harsh people, but to the public at large, I had produced something nearer to an idealization." The idea for the novel started as a screenplay for the Last Picture Show director Peter Bogdanovich, who wanted to make a period western starring John Wayne, James Stewart, and Henry Fonda. McMurtry's screenplay, Streets of Laredo, never got published, and after Wayne's death, McMurtry bought the rights back and began turning the idea into a novel. Lonesome Dove contains some character names and plot elements from Bandolero, a 1968 Western starring Stewart and written by James Lee Barrett, from a story by Stanley L. Ho. McMurtry borrowed from the 1860s cattle drives of Charles Goodnight and Oliver Loving from Texas to New Mexico, Nelson Story's 1866 drive from Texas to Montana, and Andy Adams' 1903 novel, The Log of a Cowboy. He then added strong women characters and mesmerizing prose to create what the Los Angeles Times reviewer John Horn called McMurtry's loftiest novel, a wondrous work drowned in love, melancholy, and yet ultimately excellent. In McMurtry's story, aging ex-Texas Rangers Woodrow Call and Augustus McCrae head the cattle drive. McMurtry examines their bond, an unspoken and hardly understood friendship, the Los Angeles Daily News reviewed. In Western fiction, a like friendship seldom has been more finely crafted. The Western film was supposed to be reinvigorated in 1985, but Pale Rider and Silverado never lived up to box office and critical expectations. The Western TV film revival would have to wait until Young Guns hit theaters in 1988, raking in roughly $45 million, and Lonesome Dove aired as a four-part miniseries in February 1989, drawing 26 million viewers. But McMurtry's novel helped pave the way for a slew of Western fiction with a literary bent. Gary Matthews' Heart of the Country, Pete Dexter's Deadwood, and Ralph Beer's The Blind Corral, all 1986, Robert Flynn's Wanderer Springs, 1987, and Glendon Swarthout's The Homesman, 1988. Great books, certainly, but Lonesome Dove became the 20th century classic of the West, says Austin, Texas-based novelist Stephen Harrigan, The Gates of the Alamo, Remember Ben Clayton. It was one of those rare books that had everything. A relentlessly fast-moving story with two central characters, Gus McCrae and Woodrow Call, who were not just entertaining on the page while you were reading, but would reverberate in your memory for decades afterward. In 1989, the Dallas Times-Herald newsroom was abuzz again before the miniseries premiered on CBS. Robert Duvall would be perfect as Call. But Gus? Tommy Lee Jones is too young to play Call. Robert Urich and Ricky Schroeder, they can't act. Will screenwriter William D. Whitliffe butcher McMurtry's story? Can director Simon Winsor pull this off? We didn't know what Michigan-based author Lauren D. Estelman, no slouch in the literary Western department, 1984's This Old Bill, 1987's Bloody Season, knew. TV Guide had sent Estelman to the Lonesome Dove set for a story. From the moment Danny Glover rode past me the first day wearing Dietz checkered pants, I knew the miniseries was going to be an instant classic, Esselman recalls. Adds Harrigan, who also spent time on the set, you could sense the weight of responsibility that the actors and crew were feeling. They knew Larry McMurtry's novel was beloved, and that they would never be forgiven for ruining it. Esselman interviewed Glover while the actor was being treated for cuts and scratches on his legs. He said he kept forgetting to put on protective long johns, Esselman recalls. When Esselman asked Glover how a modern actor could identify with an 1870s character, Glover replied, "The moment I'm on a horse, I'm there." But it was Duvall who gave Esselman the quote he wanted to use for the title of the TV Guide story. It's going to be the Western Godfather. The editors didn't see that and buried the story as part of a sweep feature. Nominated for 19 Emmys and winning 7, the Lonesome Dove miniseries became as revered as McMurtry's novel, leading Dallas Times Herald colleague Frank Wooten to quip, "Next will come the TV series, with Jack Klugman as Gus." A short-lived series titled Lonesome Dove, the Series, 1994 to 1995, and Lonesome Dove, the Outlaw Years, 1995 to 1996, were quickly forgotten. Klugman couldn't have hurt his reputation even if he had been cast. But a four-part sequel, Return to Lonesome Dove, written by John Wilder and directed by Mike Robe, aired in 1993. McMurtry had nothing to do with the sequel and says he never watched all of the original, and got his revenge with his own sequel, Streets of Laredo, that came out the same year and killed off the character of Newt, played by Schroeder in the original miniseries and sequel. Two other novels by McMurtry in the series, Dead Man's Walk, 1995, and Comanche Moon, 1997, also became miniseries. None recaptured the magic of the original novel or miniseries, which Skip Hollandsworth pointed out for Texas Monthly in 2016, were arguably more influential in shaping Americans' vision of the Old West than the movies of John Ford. Decades have not diminished the impact of McMurtry's original novel or the miniseries. Part of the magic of both the book and the miniseries is that Gus and Call are completely original, but also archetypal, as perfect a pairing of human opposites as Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, or Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, Harrigan says. The novel and miniseries continue to influence writers and even the families of writers, says Austin-based novelist Elizabeth Cook, Promised Land's The Which Way Tree. "I didn't finish reading the book because I got wind of the fact Gus was going to die, and I decided not to go through it. But I went through it in the movie, time and again, and so did my kids. Gus's death, Jake Spoon's death, Blue Ducks. My son was 14 when I walked into his room and found the words Jake Spoon said before his hanging scrawled across an entire wall in huge letters. I'd damn sight rather be hung by my friends than by a bunch of strangers." It was Blue Duck's death that impressed my daughter. She was about 5 when she watched him hurl himself from the jail window and asked pensively, "Mama, did Blue Duck fail his life?" It takes a great, timeless story to make a family sit and ponder the notion of whether a person can fail their life. Johnny D. Boggs also binged-watched the Lonesome Dove miniseries in 1989, starting after knocking off work at the Dallas Times Herald and finishing in tears at dawn. I'm now reading to you from the April 2020 edition of True West, Brothers in Blood, Jesse James and Billy the Kid. On April 3rd, 1882, Jesse Woodson James' life bled out of his family home in St. Joseph, Missouri, an assassin's .44-caliber bullet exploding the back of the 34-year-old bandit's skull. 9 months earlier, and more than 700 miles away in Fort Sumner, New Mexico Territory, 21-year-old outlaw William Billy the Kid Bonney died in the dark on the floor of Peter Maxwell's home from a single shot to the chest. Both men were killed by friends who had the law on their side. One even had a badge. Both assassins dreamed of gold and fame. Both outlaws were cold-blooded killers. Yet they were folk heroes even before their bloody ends. So why, as recent James and Billy biographer Bill Markley asks, do we remember their names but can't remember the names of presidents of the United States? In this special issue of True West, we try to get a little closer to the truth behind these two outlaws. We have exclusive excerpts from leading Jesse and Billy biographers T.J. Stiles, Mark Lee Gardner, and Johnny D. Boggs, who, like their predecessors, have sought answers to that 150-year-old question, why are these two killers still so popular? One young budding Billy chronicler, James B. Mills of Australia, has asked that question on his way to discovering a previously unknown Santa Fe jailhouse interview with Billy the Kid from the digitized Las Vegas Gazette. What does all this new material and historical insight on Jesse James and Billy the Kid actually mean? Maybe screenwriter David Mamet states it best. The truth is not where you expect it. And wherever that truth lies hidden, we hope to find it and bring it to you. By the editors of True West Magazine. Here is the first of two articles about Jesse James. Birth of an Outlaw Hero by Johnny D. Boggs. Shortly after Jesse James's death, journalist John Newman Edwards, longtime supporter of the James and Younger brothers, negotiated with Governor Crittenden for Frank James's surrender. On October 5th, Edwards introduced Frank to the governor, and the outlaw handed him his gun belt, saying, "Governor Crittenden, I want to hand over to you that which no living man except myself has been permitted to touch since 1861, and to say that I am your prisoner." That was impossible, however, since the revolver was a model 1875 Remington. Frank was brought to trial in Gallatin, Missouri in 1883 for the Winston train robbery. The trial of the century was a media sensation, with six attorneys handling the state's prosecution and eight defending Frank James. Perhaps fittingly, the trial was held in an opera house. On September 6th, in less than 4 hours of deliberation, the jury brought in a verdict of not guilty. The following year, Frank was tried in Huntsville, Alabama, for the Muscle Shoals robbery and again acquitted. In 1885, the state of Missouri dropped its last case against Frank, who became a free man. He was never tried for the Northfield robbery. By then, the James brothers were big news. Shortly after Jesse's death, a song, perhaps written by a minstrel named Billy Gashade, became popular. Its chorus went, "Jesse had no wife to mourn for his life. Three children, they were brave. But that dirty little coward that shot Mr. Howard has laid Jesse James in his grave." Even before Jesse's death, books had been published about him. Edwards's Noted Guerrillas or the Warfare of the Border came out in 1877, 2 years after Augustus C. Appler's The Guerrillas of the West, or The Life, Character, and Daring Exploits of the Younger Brothers. In 1881, the 5-cent Wide Awake Library began publishing stories about the James Gang. After Jesse's death, books, often sporting titles like Jesse James, The Midnight Horseman, or The Silent Rider of the Ozarks, and The James Boys and the Mad Sheriff, or The Midnight Run of 99, became popular. William F. Buffalo Bill Cody was most likely the only actual person who appeared as a hero in more dime novels than Jesse James. Bob and Charlie Ford appeared in a traveling play, How I Killed Jesse James. Z. James and Zerelda Samuel were alleged to have countered by contracting with Frank Triplett for his book, The Lifetimes and Treacherous Death of Jesse James. By the 1890s, plays about Jesse James, including W.I. Swain's Western Spectaculars, Jesse James, were commonplace and highly fictitious. Even Cole Younger, paroled in 1901, and Frank James got in on the act. In 1903, they toured the country in The Great Cole Younger and Frank James Historical Wild West Show. Few books and plays had any semblance to history. As Frank said, "If I admitted that these stories were true, people would say, 'There is the greatest scoundrel unhung.' And if I denied them, they'd say, 'There's the greatest liar on earth.' So I just say nothing." That same year that Frank and Cole Younger launched their Wild West exhibition, Pennsylvania-born Edwin Stanton Porter, fledgling filmmaker in the fledgling film industry, shot a Western-set motion picture, The Great Train Robbery, in New Jersey. Response to the movie was so tremendous that Nickelodeons began springing up across the nation. From then on, film historians George N. Finnan and William K. Everson wrote, "The Western was a genre of the American cinema." It wouldn't take long before filmmakers decided to spotlight Jesse James. Note, Birth of an Outlaw Hero, Jesse James and Pop Culture, 1875 to 1903, is excerpted from Jesse James and the Movies, copyright 2011, Johnny D. Boggs, by permission of McFarland & Company, Incorporated, Box 611, Jefferson, North Carolina, 28640, McFarlandBooks.com. Jesse James, The Birth of a Killer, by T.J. Stiles. The wails, the babble of words, the murmuring of the crowd. Suddenly stopped as two young men appeared. They stepped past the body, approached a town marshal who stood close by, and offered to surrender. They had killed this man, one of them declared, and now they expected their reward. The lawman looked at them in astonishment. "My God," he said, "do you mean to tell us that this is Jesse James?" "Yes," the pair replied in unison. Those who were standing near, the reporter wrote, drew in their breaths in silence at the thought of being so near Jesse James, even if he was dead. Robin Hood or Hooded Bandit? Jesse James was not an inarticulate avenger for the poor. His popularity was driven by politics, politics based on wartime allegiances, and was rooted among former Confederates. Even his attacks on unpopular economic targets, the banks and the railroads, turn out, on closer inspection, to have had political resonances. He was, in fact, a major force in the attempt to create a Confederate identity for Missouri, a cultural and political offensive waged by the defeated rebels to undo the triumph of the radical Republicans in the Civil War. His robberies, his murders, his letters to the newspapers, and his starring role in ex-Shelby Brigade cavalry officer John N. Edwards's Kansas City Times columns all played a part in the Confederate effort to achieve wartime goals by political means, to use historian Christopher Phillips' neat reversal of Clausewitz's dictum. Had Jesse James existed a century earlier, he would have been called a terrorist. Terrorist? The term hardly fits with the traditional image of him as a Wild West outlaw, yipping and yelling and shooting it out with the county sheriff. But he saw himself as a Southerner, a Confederate, a vindicator of the rebel cause. And so he must be seen in the context of Southern outlaws, particularly the Klan and other highly political parliamentary forces. Even more important, he was not simply a puppet of John Edwards, but an active participant in the creation of his own legend. Edwards's glorification of the bushwhacker bandits only began after the publicity-minded James rose to leadership and began to demand attention on his own. An avid student of current affairs, he sometimes outdid his editor friend in his public attacks on the radical Republicans, to Edwards's evident alarm. Was he a criminal? Yes. Was he in it for the money? Yes. Did he choose all his targets for political effect? No. He cannot be confused with the Red Brigades, the Tamil Tigers, Osama bin Laden, or other groups that now shape our image of terrorism. But he was a political partisan in a hotly partisan era, and he eagerly offered himself up as a polarizing symbol of the Confederate project for post-war Missouri. There remains, of course, the straightforward power of his story. His is a tale of ambushes, gun battles, and daring raids, of narrow escapes, betrayals, and revenge. Even his oddly alliterative name seems to have been conjured up by a novelist of overripe adventures. But an accurate understanding of his world can only add to the drama. When we look at his life in its proper setting, if we see it as did that crowd that held its breath around his body on 13th and Lafayette, we see that the life of Jesse James was as significant as it was thrilling. Clay County Plowboy to Missouri Marauder. It was a savage set of men who returned with Frank that April 1864. Already hardened by war, they had been blistered by butchery at Lawrence and debauchery in Texas. And Charles Fletcher Taylor, the man who led the small squad that crossed over to Clay County, was one of the hardest. Short, broad-shouldered, sporting a neatly trimmed mustache and beard, Fletch had fought with the Quantrill from the beginning, scouting out Lawrence before the raid, murdering the innocent in its streets, then riding to Texas. But there he turned against his master, murdering a Confederate officer and resisting Quantrill's attempt to arrest him. Now he fought, in the phrase of the times, on his own hook. Cantering beside him was an even smaller, even more vicious killer, little Archie Clement, a gray-eyed 18-year-old from Johnson County. Barely 5 feet tall, he looked more like a jockey than a gorilla, but he was already an experienced gunman, and he would soon win the lasting admiration of Frank's little brother. A year after being dragged through the tobacco field by the provisional militia, 3 years after Frank first enlisted in the State Guard, Jesse rode to war. Guided by Frank or another Clay County recruit in late May, he would have crept out at night and sneaked down hog trails to the rugged Fishing River, where Taylor and Clement lay hidden. There seems to be something of the death-like brooding over these camps, wrote Sergeant Sherman Bodwell in his diary, after finding an abandoned bushwhacker bivouac. Always hidden where hardly more than a horse track points the way, in heavy timber and creek bottoms, lying about, cooking utensils, cast-off clothing. Jesse would have seen a cluster of men gathered around the fire under an awning of low leaves and branches, cooking a meal, drying out socks, cleaning and loading weapons. A strong smell of horses, sweat, and waste, human and animal, would have struck him, followed by the dense smoke of burning green wood, with undertones of oiled leather and wet flannel. They were all young, some astonishingly young, like Jesse himself. If you ever want to pick a company to do desperate work, Frank later mused, select young men from 17 to 21 years old. Take our company, and there have never been a more reckless lot of them. Only one or two were over 25. Most of them were under 21. Scarcely a dozen boasted a mustache. Or, as another grizzled veteran put it, almost exactly a century after Jesse crept into that camp, you're going to learn that one of the most brutal things in the world is your average 19-year-old American boy. The Making of a Marauder. Now the ritual began. First was the matter of equipment. Either Zerelda or Charlotte sewed a gorilla shirt for Jesse, a loose pullover with two deep breast pockets for percussion caps, powder charges, and 36 caliber lead balls. Then he needed pistols, a horse, and a saddle. The revolver was the primary weapon, its rapid rate of fire well suited to guerrilla ambushes. Before the war, Colt's revolvers had been somewhat uncommon, even in Missouri, and they were hard to get legitimately after the conflict began. But the bushwhackers equipped themselves through smuggling, theft, and plundering of the Union dead. So, if Jesse didn't have a set, one was given to him. As for horses, he would have been told to steal them. The last lesson was the start of a much deeper, more lasting education. They were guerrillas. They were not engaged in a war that a colonel of the Army or the Potomac or a general of the Army of Northern Virginia could recognize. They had no lines, no objectives, no strategy, no command structure. Theirs was a purely tactical war, a war to inflict pain, to punish, to kill, and destroy. Every barn and brook was a battlefield. Every civilian, either an ally or a target. By stepping into that brooding, death-like camp, Jesse James entered a race to find and kill as many enemies as he could. Mayhem and murder. On April 29, 1864, Major General William S. Rosecrans telegraphed an alert to Colonel James H. Moss in Liberty. The guerrillas were returning, he warned, to re-inaugurate the scenes of murder and robbery which have desolated your country during the past 3 years. Rosecrans, humiliated by defeat at the Battle of Chickamauga, had been shifted in January to command the Department of the Missouri, a strategic eddy far from the main channels of the war. The state might have been a backwater, but Rosecrans learned that its currents were swift and unpredictable. Accustomed to wielding brigades, divisions, and corps, as he marched toward objectives, he now had to weave a net out of slender companies, battalions, and regiments as he waded into guerrilla waters, and no units threatened to unravel more quickly than Colonel Moss's troublesome pawpaws. "I expect from you and the enrolled militia under your command," he wrote, "such a reception as will amply vindicate you from all the charges of disloyalty which have been urged against you." Moss assured Rosecrans that all would be well. Brigadier General Clinton B. Fisk was not so certain. After a military reorganization in January, this stern and voluble officer had assumed command of the District of North Missouri after serving in the southeastern corner of the state. Fisk had received his rank in part through connections in the northern branch of the Methodist Church, an avowedly abolitionist denomination. The savagery of the guerrilla war, however, had negated whatever Christian charity remained within him. Rather than rely on Moss, he shifted Captain William B. Kemper and part of Company K, 9th Cavalry Regiment, MSM, to Liberty in early May 1864. "Clean out and kill every marauding, thieving villain you find," he wrote to Kemper on May 15th, adding, "keep your eyes on the pawpaws." The captain needed no instructions to that point. He intended to avoid Moss's men at all costs as he pursued the bushwhackers, and the guerrillas were back. He could feel it. But every time he sent squads to scout the countryside, they came back empty-handed. On May 24th, Kemper changed tactics. After nightfall, he ordered 15 men to draw rations, mount their horses, and follow him into the country, where he deployed in ambush. After spending a day waiting for the enemy, he gathered his troopers out of hiding and moved on to another spot. Meanwhile, he sent out two spies. Each night he rendezvoused with them to better plan his trap for the following day. Across the Missouri River, the 2nd Colorado Cavalry employed the same tactics with devastating effect. Kemper, however, had fewer men and experienced opponents. Fletch Taylor and Archie Clement easily slipped past his ambushes to deliver a sharp reminder that there was no line between combatants and civilians. On June 1st, they led their Clay County recruits, dressed in captured Union uniforms, to the farm of Bradley Bond. Gathering outside the front door, they asked to see the man of the house. When Bond stepped outside, they shot him to death. The next day, they murdered Alvis Dagley in a field not far from the Samuel place, then trotted to his house and coldly told his widow. Over the next few weeks, the gang killed at least 8 Unionist civilians. Men were slain before the eyes of their wives and children, one resident wrote, or else shot down without mercy by the roadside and their bodies left to fester and corrupt in the sun. Property was taken and destroyed on every hand. Business of all kinds prostrated. Values were unsettled. Everything was disturbed. They killed one slave for fun, and they looted as freely as the worst Jayhawkers or militia. The keenest and cleanest fighter. Jesse James never attempted to distance himself from this slaughter. In later years, one of his closest friends boasted of how Jesse and Frank went alone to the home of a local Unionist just after the death of Dagley and murdered him outside his house. This, then, was his introduction to warfare, not as a gladiator in battle against a tyrannous foe, but as a member of a death squad, picking off neighbors one by one. Of all the departures in Jesse James's dramatic life, none would ever be so momentous or portentous as this one. He had violence coaches on every side, from Zerelda, who explicitly praised the worst rebel atrocities, to his brother Frank. After he took to the brush, Taylor and Clement took over as his mentors. They mocked him for his boyish diffidence, nicknaming him Dingus after a euphemistic curse he once uttered. But once he joined in the killing, they gave him their respect. Not to have any beard, one of the deadliest guerrillas supposedly said of him, he is the keenest and cleanest fighter in the command. Jesse abandoned all civil norms, even as the blunt instrument morality of a slave-owning culture. He now belonged to a group that believed a man must murder for respect. Jesse James, Birth of a Killer, by T.J. Stiles, is excerpted from his book, Jesse James, Last Rebel of the Civil War, New York Vintage Press, a division of Random House, Incorporated. Here's another article from True West Magazine on Billy the Kid. Special Classic Gunfights, Shootout at Stinking Springs, by Bob Bowes Bell. December 23, 1880. Riding at midnight through deep snow, Sheriff-elect Pat Garrett leads a 13-man posse eastward out of Fort Sumner, New Mexico. After questioning several people in Fort Sumner and ascertaining the kid's dress, especially his hat, which is said to be a Mexican sugar loaf with a green hat band, Garrett decides he won't take any chances. When the kid makes his appearance, Garrett will kill him and hope the rest surrender. After a 10-mile ride to the Brazil Wilcox Ranch, where Billy the Kid and his compadres were last seen, Garrett picks up their trail clearly in the snow. Following this trail, a short distance, he recounts, I am convinced that they made for Stinking Springs. A half mile away from the house, Garrett and his men hold a conference. Around 3 a.m., with Juan Robel left in charge of the horses, Garrett divides his squad and circles the house with half the force, finding a dry arroyo fairly close to the house. The men dig in. Frank Stewart and the rest of the posse conceal themselves about 200 yards from the other side of the building. They see three horses tied to the vigas, roof beams sticking out of the wall, outside the stone house, and conclude that two mounts must be inside with the outlaws. Garrett sends a message to Stewart of their plan of attack. Stealthily enter the house, cover them with our guns, and hold them until daylight. Lee Hall favors the suggestion. Stewart does not. Garrett is overruled. The men shiver and attempt to stay warm until daylight, about a four-hour wait. It's so cold, posse member Charlie Rudolph gets frostbite on his feet. As the posse members wait, they hear snoring from inside the rock house. The hours drag by, and the temperature seems to get colder as the men look for any sign of movement from the inmates. The lanky sheriff commands a direct view of the doorway. While waiting for the kid's sombrero to pop into view, Garrett orders his men, "When I bring up my gun, you raise and fire." As the weak rays of sunlight began streaking the horizon, the posse hears movement in the house. Shortly, a man appears in the doorway with a nose bag, feed bag for the horses. The man's head is down, but Garrett sees a Mexican hat with a green band and brings his Winchester rifle to his shoulder. Seven bullets rip through the pale dawn light. The man reels into the house, and the horses pull at their tethers. The inmates inside are now awake, trying to avoid the trampling hooves of their four-legged bunkmates. Billy Wilson's voice is heard. Bowdry is killed and wants to come out. Garrett yells for them to come out with his hands up. As Charlie Bowdry staggers to the door, the kid catches hold of his belt, draws his revolver around in front of Bowdry, and says, "They have murdered you, Charlie, but you can get revenge. Kill some of those sons of bitches before you die." Bowdry comes out with his hands barely up. He stumbles toward the posse until he recognizes Garrett, and he goes straight at him. Motioning with his hands at the house and strangling in his own blood, he gasps, I wish. Then with a whisper, "I'm dying," he falls into Garrett's arms. The lawman gently lays him on his blankets. As the morning light brightens, Garrett notices the rope ties on one of the outside horses is moving. He quickly surmises that the outlaws are trying to bring the horses inside in order to make a break. Garrett shoots the horse dead and it drops in the doorway. To stop any more attempts, Garrett takes careful aim and shoots the ropes of the other horses. The animals walk away and are captured by Stewart's men. Garrett opens up a conversation with the inmates, and the kid answers as their spokesman. Garrett asks how he is fixed in there. "Pretty well," the kid coolly answers, "but we have no wood to get breakfast." "Come out," Garrett says, "and get some. Be a little sociable." "Can't do it, Pat," the kid replies. "Business is too confining. No time to run around." Garrett decides to eat breakfast, so he goes with half the men back 3 miles to the Brazil Wilcox Ranch headquarters. After the meal, Garrett makes arrangements with Thomas Wilcox to deliver food for the men, forage for the horses, and wood. As the wagon is being loaded, Garrett returns to Stinking Springs and relieves Stewart, who gathers up his men to go to breakfast. Garrett then invites the kid out for coffee. "Go to hell, Pat," says the kid, obviously losing a bit of his jolly humor. Soon, the posse members on the east side begin to hear sounds of picking. Evidently, the outlaws are trying to break out or at least make firing ports. Garrett sends Tom Emery and James East to stop it. A few well-aimed shots end the picking, but the horses get scared and are about to run over Billy and his men. Billy later tells a reporter, "If it hadn't have been for the dead horse in the doorway, I wouldn't have been captured. But I couldn't ride out over that, for my horse would have jumped back and I would have got it in the head." At about 3 p.m., the kid turns loose the two horses he's holding inside, and the posse picks them up. At 4 p.m., the Wilcox wagon arrives, and the men build a big fire and go to cooking. The smell of roasting meat is too much for the outlaws. Dirty Dave Rudabach sticks a handkerchief that had once been white on the end of a stick and calls out for a surrender. Garrett tells them to come out with their hands up, but only Dirty Dave leaves the house to talk with him. The outlaws want a guarantee of protection from violence. Garrett agrees, and Dirty Dave returns to the house. After a few minutes, all four outlaws come out with their hands raised. The kid is the last. According to legend, before the kid steps out, he urinates on the weapons. As the inmates approach the posse, Barney Mason levels his rifle at the kid and spits out, "Kill the son of a bitch. He's slippery and may get away." Posse members Tom Emery and Jim East are appalled at Mason's treachery and aim their Winchesters at Garrett's friend. One of them says, "If you fire a shot, we'll kill you." Mason backs off. After the kid and his men are disarmed, the outlaws shake hands with every man who captured them. The prisoners are taken to the Brazil Wilcox Ranch, where Mrs. Wilcox feeds the whole lot. Garrett sends a wagon back to retrieve Bowdry's body, and everyone stays overnight at the ranch. A long, slow slog. The next day is Christmas Eve, and by noon, the lawmen and their prisoners reach Fort Sumner, where they headquarter at Beaver Smith's saloon and eat lunch while the prisoners are shackled together. In the afternoon, Garrett leads his men and a wagon full of prisoners towards Las Vegas in deep snow. They have Christmas dinner at Padre Polacco's store in Puerto de Luna, and then after the wagon axle breaks, the posse travels all night and arrives in Las Vegas by late morning on December 26th. As Garrett gets ready to leave for Santa Fe on a train, a mob meets them at the station. They want Dirty Dave Rudabaugh. The standoff lasts for an hour. Train interview. A mob met Garrett and his posse and prisoners at the train station. As Garrett successfully stood off the mob, Billy casually talked to a reporter for the Las Vegas Gazette. "We saw him again at the depot when the crowd presented a really warlike appearance. Standing by the car, out of one of the windows of which he was leaning, he talked freely with us of the whole affair. I don't blame you for writing of me as you have. You had to believe other stories. But then I don't know as anyone would believe anything good of me anyway," he said. "I wasn't the leader of any gang. I was for Billy all the time. About the Portales business, I owned the rancho with Charlie Bowdry. I took it up and was holding it because I wanted to keep it for a station. But I found there were certain men who wouldn't let me live in the country. And so I was going to leave. We had all our grub in the house when they took us in, and we were going to a place about 6 miles away in the morning to cook it and then light out. I haven't stolen any stock. I made my living by gambling, but that was the only way I could live. They wouldn't let me settle down. If they had, I wouldn't be here today." And he held up his right arm, on which was the bracelet. "Chisholm got me into all this trouble, and then wouldn't help me out. If it hadn't been for the dead horse in the doorway at Stinking Springs, I wouldn't be here. I would have ridden my bay mare and taken my chances of escaping," said he. "But I couldn't ride out over that, for she would have jumped back and I would have got it in the head. We could have stayed in the house, but there wouldn't have been anything gained by that, for they would have starved us out. I thought it was better to come out and get a good square meal, don't you? The prospects of a fight exhilarated him, and he bitterly bemoaned being chained. If I only had my Winchester, I'd lick the whole crowd, was his confident comment on the strength of the attacking party. He sighed and sighed again for a chance to take a hand in the fight, and the burden of his desire was to be set free to fight on the side of his captors as soon as he should smell powder. As the train rolled out, he lifted his hat and invited us to call and see him in Santa Fe, calling out, "Adios." Billy delivered. December 27, 1880. The mob wants Dirty Dave Radabaugh. He killed jailer Lino Valdez during an unsuccessful bid to free crony J.J. Webb in April. Garrett promised Dave at Stinking Springs he would take him to Santa Fe. The standoff lasts for half an hour, then an associate of Garrett's runs up to the engine and opens the throttle. The huge steam engine spins in its tracks for several seconds, then rockets past the platform and leaves the angry mob behind. It is Billy's first ride on a train. He is as excited as a kid can be. The posse-men have been on the trail for weeks, sleeping in the same clothes, riding in the bitter cold. They look every bit as rough as the men they have captured. To the other passengers, there is no discernible difference between captive and captor. Due to heavy snowfall, the train stalls at Glorieta Pass for several hours. Billy amuses the boys by ordering a piece of apple pie and placing the entire slice in his mouth. He opens his mouth and, ta-da! It's still in one piece. As Garrett and his posse yuck it up over this hilarious entertainment, one thing is obvious to the conductor. These boys need to get out more. Garrett deposits his prisoners with Sheriff Sherman in Santa Fe. There is a small snafu when Garrett orders food for the prisoners and the jailer eats it all. Now we'll move on to the articles about Billy the Kid from True West Magazine's April 2020 edition. To Hell on a Fast Horse, 10 Years On, by Mark Lee Gardner. In 2010, shortly after the first publication of my book, To Hell on a Fast Horse, I learned that New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson was again giving serious consideration to granting a posthumous pardon to Billy the Kid. Billy had been promised a pardon by then-Governor Lew Wallace in exchange for his testimony before a grand jury investigating a murder Billy witnessed. At great personal risk to himself, Billy gave his testimony, but the pardon never came. If Wallace had indeed wronged Billy by not issuing the pardon, Richardson wanted to make it right before he left office at the end of the year. Too late for Billy, of course, but not for history buffs the world over. I broke the story of the potential pardon for one of the Old West's most famous outlaws with an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times. A deal is a deal, I argued then, half playfully. And 129 years doesn't change that. Billy is owed a pardon. The news of what Richardson was considering raced across front pages and internet browsers faster than a bullet from Billy's Colt Thunderer, and it came with considerable controversy. Soon, the New York Times asked fellow author Hampton Sides for his opinion, and Hampton, who lives in Billy's old stomping grounds of New Mexico, didn't hold back. He referred to the kid as a thug and a trigger-happy sociopath. What's to be gained, Hampton asked, by dredging up stories from a tired old shoot-em-up? Hampton by no means was the only Billy hater out there. The descendants of Sheriff Pat Garrett were also strongly opposed to a pardon, which they believed would diminish their ancestors' unrelenting efforts to bring law and order to southeastern New Mexico territory. It was a good argument, but the posthumous pardon was about symbolic justice for Billy. It couldn't and wouldn't erase Garrett's heroics as sheriff of Lincoln County. Finally, on the last day of 2010, Governor Richardson announced his decision, live on national television, which tells you just how big the pardon issue had become. "I've decided not to pardon Billy the Kid," the governor told his hosts on ABC's Good Morning America. "Because of a lack of conclusiveness and the historical ambiguity as to why Governor Wallace reneged on his pardon." Richardson's decision was certainly a disappointment for the romantics among us, but the months-long saga did prove Hampton Sides wrong about one thing. The Kid's story was anything but tired, and 10 years on, it shows no signs of letting up. Sorry, Hampton. A case in point, I'm happy to say, is To Hell on a Fast Horse, which has gone through multiple printings and now a special 10th anniversary edition. Not a year passed since my book first appeared, it seems, that the Kid didn't make headlines. In June 2011, the only surviving authentic photograph of the outlaw, a tintype, sold at auction in Denver, Colorado, for $2.3 million. The presale estimate was $300,000 to $400,000. It remains the highest price ever paid for a 19th century photograph. I was at the auction and had the privilege of looking Billy square in the face, so to speak, before the rare image passed into the private collection of the winning bidder, billionaire and Old West enthusiast William I. Bill Koch. A predictable result of the tintype sale was the sudden appearance of a number of historic photographs purportedly picturing one Billy the Kid that had been scrounged from flea markets, antique shops, and eBay. With stamps of approval from self-proclaimed photo authenticators using controversial facial recognition technology, each new discovery was touted by the press, and the owners of the images naturally believed they'd hit the jackpot. In 2015, the National Geographic Channel even featured one of these images, a tintype said to picture young Billy playing croquet at a genteel outing with his friends, in a 90-minute documentary broadcast internationally. Despite all the hoopla, none of these wannabe kid photos has passed muster with knowledgeable historians, myself included. And while I do believe it's likely that Billy stared down the lens of a box camera more than once in his 21 years, any historic photo put forth as a portrait of the Kid cannot be based on resemblance alone. It must have a rock-solid provenance linking it to the outlaw. Otherwise, it can never be anything more than a picture of a goofy-looking juvenile that looks a little like that fuzzy, dim portrait of William H. Bonney. Of course, my book is just as much about Pat Garrett as it is the Kid, and I had thought my unconventional take, i.e. sympathetic, on the once-revered sheriff might help to rehabilitate his tarnished image. But there are many who continue to have a negative view of the man forever known for gunning down young Billy. In 2018, the Doña Ana County Historical Society proposed that a Las Cruces, New Mexico street be renamed from Motel Boulevard, which boasted only one motel, to Pat Garrett Boulevard to honor the county's most famous lawman. Their proposal didn't get very far with the city council, however. The councilor was quoted as saying that naming a street after a white symbol of the Old West was very offensive to me. The boulevard continues to honor that lone motel. Numerous articles and books touching on the Kid or Garrett have been published since To Hell on a Fast Horse first appeared. But if I were rewriting my book today, there would be no changes to my narrative, simply because no previously unseen primary sources have come to light that would necessitate a change. I should, however, provide an update on one item, the lawsuit over Billy's possible DNA and its analysis. After an enormous amount of time and money spent in the New Mexico courts, the official lab results were made public in 2012, which revealed that the blood samples tested, whether or not they belonged to the kid remains unknown, did not have enough DNA to generate a good sequence, other than it being a win for the freedom of information. The result of all the legal wrangling was a letdown for Billy Buffs. I've written other books since To Hell on a Fast Horse came out, but I continue to be passionate about the kid and Pat Garrett. To me, their story remains thrilling, tragic, and irresistible, worthy of telling in the 21st century. And I trust the two will continue to gallop across people's imaginations into the 22nd century as well. At least, I hope so. I wonder, though, how many more photographs of Billy the Kid we'll have by then. Unpardonable is excerpted from the 10th anniversary edition of Mark Lee Gardner's To Hell on a Fast Horse, which will be released by William Morrow in April 2020. Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been... Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by Music and Memories at 1.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
All Ector County senior centers are closed to the public until further notice. The Northside Senior Center will serve lunch and carry out trays for seniors 60 and older. Call in advance by 9 a.m. at 432-337-5281. Again, that number is 337-5281. Pickup times will be from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the center, 1225 Adams Avenue.
Thursday nights at 7, we bring you news of interest on the AARP report. Information from one of the largest organizations serving people 50 and over for more than half a century. Then at 7:30, it's the Diabetes Show, a 30-minute program that provides news and information gathered from resources around the country. The AARP Report and the Diabetes Show. Thursdays beginning at 7 p.m. and Fridays at 5 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 83 and partly cloudy. Tonight, thunderstorms with a low in the upper 60s. Then, tomorrow, sunny with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour, an hour-long reading of books hand-selected by staff and read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hachette Audio presents Texas Outlaw, written by James Patterson and Andrew Burrell. Read by Christopher Ryan Grant. Chapter 75. When Dale hangs up, I put my truck into drive and take off. Dale could be setting a trap for me. And Ariana. He works for McCormick, after all. I could be leading us both into God knows what kind of trouble. Gareth and his soldier buddies could surround us out there in the desert canyons and force us to surrender at gunpoint. Or kill us. But I'm not sure I have much of a choice. Dale might be my last hope. I pull onto Main Street. The harsh glare from the late afternoon sun reflects off the cars parked along the road. Up ahead, I see a pickup truck driving into town. I recognize it. It's just like mine. I pull over, and my lieutenant, Kyle Hendricks, pulls over too, parking his truck nose to nose with mine. He climbs out, and so do I. We stand in the middle of Main Street, two Texas Rangers with cowboy hats and sidearms, staring at each other like a couple of gunfighters in